Welcome to the Experts in Sport podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast seeks to bring together the worlds of academia and professional practice. If you're interested in the latest research and trends in sport, then this is the podcast for you. Today, I'm with Dr. Sam Winter and Professor John Dickinson, and we're here to talk about respiratory physiology. We discuss the mechanisms of breathing and how even elite athletes may not be breathing efficiently. We discuss asthma and its high prevalence in elite athletes, before finally discussing how the OEP system is being used to detect dysfunctional breathing to help improve performance. Hi Sam, hi John, thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Hi.
Hi.
And to get us started, would you guys just be able to give us a brief introduction to your background, starting with yourself, Sam?
Sure. So my name's Sam Winter. I'm at Loughborough University and I'm a biomechanist by training. And I tend to work in sort of health applications of biomechanics, although it often is the case that actually you start in a particular area and the things that you learn can apply to other areas as well. So it tends to work its way back to sport. What I've been working on most recently is basically a motion capture system which can track the chest wall during breathing and detect certain things about the way that we breathe and breathing patterns and how those differ between different groups. And that's how I've met John and worked with him.
Good segue into John. So John, introduce yourself, please.
Hi, my name's John Dickinson. I'm a professor at the University of Kent. I've been dealing with elite athletes for around about 20 years now, helping them overcome various respiratory problems. By training, I'm a sports scientist. I probably describe myself as an applied exercise respiratory physiologist. But I kind of verge a little bit across into sports medicine and into exercise respiratory physiology, supporting athletes, getting objective testing done, and also helping them overcome maybe respiratory problems that aren't always easily answered by simply calling an athlete asthmatic.
Brilliant. So I'm hoping by the end of this podcast, all our listeners will get to understand breathing and everything that we need to know about it, especially for some athletes as well.
Yeah.
So to get us started, will you guys just be able to explain to us the basics of breathing and breathing technique?
Yeah, I'll kick off with that if you want, Sam. This is probably the crux of the podcast is if you actually to ask us what is good breathing technique, then objectively, it's very difficult to actually to say that. But what we know is obviously you have respiratory muscles. So we all probably know the diaphragm. And we also have muscles in between our ribs called the intercostal muscles. And what we need is actually those muscles to contract, simply the diaphragm and the external intercostal muscles to contract to actually move our rib cage. And what happens is by moving that rib cage, it lowers the pressure inside of the lungs. That allows air to come in. And then we supply our lungs with air that's high in oxygen, so 21% oxygen. And obviously we can then exchange gas in the alveoli, so the bottom of the lung. And then we breathe out, so we get a contraction of the rib cage, relaxation of the diaphragm, a little bit of contraction of the internal intercostal muscles, and we breathe out. Now, what is a good method of breathing is debatable. And you might hear, we touched on it a little bit when we were doing the pre-record for this, we're talking about belly breathing versus chest breathing. What we actually think is what we need is the lower rib cage should be moving during shallow kind of rested breathing. Then the deeper we breathe, the more the rib cage we move. Now, when you hear belly breathing, what's actually happening is the lower rib cage, so the floating ribs that kind of go kind of down the side of your abdomen, they're the part that's moving. So they're the part that's moving, and that's where you see the belly breathing. But actually, it's not your belly actually pushing out, it's your lower rib cage moving that actually causes a rise in the abdomen. And so that's when people refer to belly breathing. It's not actually that, it's just lower rib cage movement. And then the deeper you breathe, the more rib cage you move. And effectively, that's kind of the crux of a good breathing pattern. And what you want to try and avoid is kind of shallow breathing up in your upper chest. So we see a lot of dysfunctional breathers, a lot of hyperventilators. They use a lot of shoulder breathing very high up in their breath. And that results in a higher breathing frequency and can result in compromising oxygen transfer into the blood and then has knock-on effects from there.
So just when you talk about oxygen transfer into the blood, can you just briefly explain how that happens and how it's restricted from this shallow breathing?
Yeah, so obviously when we're breathing, we want to obviously breathe to what we call ventilate the airway. So that's obviously going to mean why we want to do that is because obviously our body needs oxygen to produce energy, to help produce our energy aerobically. So when we take a big deep breath in, blood coming into the lungs is what we call deoxygenated. So it's gone through the body, it's come back to the heart, and it gets pumped to the lungs to go and collect more oxygen and get rid of carbon dioxide. And so as the blood's passing over the lungs, it's got relatively low oxygen in the blood and relatively high oxygen inside the lungs in the alveoli. And at that point, it's simply oxygen's going to move down a diffusion gradient. So you've got high oxygen concentration in the alveoli, low oxygen concentration in the blood. Simply, the oxygen's going to diffuse across the alveoli wall, across the capillary wall, into the blood. It gets caught by a red blood cell. And the opposite happens to CO2. So CO2 is high concentration in the blood as it enters the lung, and low concentration of CO2 in the lung. And so CO2 moves the other way, and then we kind of get what we call a gas transfer. So when you breathe out the CO2 that is kind of byproduct of energy production, and your blood leaves the lung, what we get high in oxygen concentration. So then it can be distributed around the body for aerobic energy production.
Taking me back to my sports science days there. So very, very well explained. And I'm sure we now have got the basics of breathing. I know from some of your guys' research that you mentioned things like body size, age, gender, all may affect breathing. Could you touch upon a few of those for us and tell us how that might affect breathing?
Yeah, again, long term, I don't think I don't think it's been studied enough to really get a good gauge of kind of how breathing patterns might change through aging or by gender. I don't think we can probably go there too much. What we do know, though, is that your lung function tends to decrease over time. So once you become a fully grown adult, from the age of around about 25, 30, you'll see a steady progressive loss in lung function over time. When we say loss in lung function, what we mean is the total amount of air that you can expire from your lungs might drop a little bit, and also the speed that the air comes out of your lungs might drop a little bit. And it's difficult to say how fast it will go, but it will depend on the individual. It can be genetic, and it can also depend whether you've got airway diseases as well, and also the exposure to pollutants, or whether you smoke, or whether you live in a smoking household. The greater exposure to pollutants or smoke will potentially increase the risk of a faster decline in lung function.
Brilliant. And I think we're going to talk later on potentially about COVID and potentially about kind of obesity and effects like that. But I think for now, should we have a look at the athlete side of things?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So obviously, breathing is important for athletes. VO2 maxes and this kind of thing are very important. But I know we're going to touch upon athletes and asthma. So do you want to just get us started really on the effects of asthma and salbutamol use among athletes and why it's fairly prevalent from some of your guys' research?
Yeah, I mean, it might be surprising to hear that athletes are more susceptible to airway disease such as asthma. So asthma is the most common chronic disease that athletes report. Respiratory symptoms themselves are the most frequently reported at major championships like Olympic Games. So their respiratory problems just generally are quite common among athletes. When we look at asthma specifically, the general population prevalence of asthma is around about 9% in the UK. When we look at the British Olympic team, so some of my early research, part of my PhD, we demonstrated 21% of the British Olympic team have an asthmatic condition. And what we see actually is a range in terms of prevalence across sports. So some sports are around about the 9% prevalence. So a sport like boxing, for example, is about 8% prevalence from some of the research that we've produced. But then the risk of an athlete experiencing asthma increases when the sport is high ventilation, it's sustained high ventilation, and or it takes place in a what kind of an asthmogenic environment. An asthmogenic environment might be polluted, might be cold, dry air. And when we see that the combination of high ventilation in an asthmogenic environment, we see much higher prevalences than the general population. To give a few examples, we've got things like elite cycling prevalence is around about 40%. Elite swimming prevalence, we've reported it around about just under 70% for the elite British swimming team. So you can see very high prevalences in some sports and maybe not so much in other sports. And a lot of that's down to not just the athletes going into it, their genetic makeup. A lot of it is caused from the environment and the conditions of the sport they're being asked to put their bodies through.
Isn't it true that the prevalence in the general population is round about 9%? So round about the level of the boxers that you mentioned. So yeah. Just to put it in perspective, if you're talking about rates of kind of, you know, 40 to 70%, that's a lot higher than you expect to find in the general population.
Yeah. And it's not just British athletes. That's been also reported. So we see similar problems with cross-country skiers in Scandinavian countries. It's a prevalence around about 50% in those types of sports, and about 35% in ice skaters. So it's not just the UK data. It's quite commonly known around the world that athletes are more susceptible to asthma. What we also know is that asthma is not the only breathing problem athletes can face. So we know that they can experience various other problems. Just to give you some data from a very recent study that has been published that I was involved with from the English Institute of Sport, where they looked at 122 elite athletes. 80% of those athletes reported at least one respiratory health issue. And those respiratory health issues, half of them were from a nasal issue. Around about 35% were either allergy or a laryngeal problem, so an upper airway issue or an allergic issue. 22% of them were asthmatic issues, and 22% of them were a condition called dysfunctional breathing, which is kind of an umbrella term for not maybe having the appropriate breath. So quite a range of issues that athletes can face. The second thing is that 60% of the athletes that had a respiratory issue also had another respiratory issue. So what that kind of says is, what just because maybe you pick up asthma or you pick up a nasal issue, that doesn't mean that that is the only problem the athlete might face. And so what we're really promoting when we work with athletes, and this should really be, it doesn't have to be athletes, it should be with everybody really, there should be a systematic assessment for respiratory health rather than simply just an investigation for one aspect of respiratory health. And I think that would help one, make sure that athletes themselves are being cared for appropriately. But if you think about holistically, for people that maybe aren't elite athletes, it would mean that if they ever get out of breath, for example, someone might have a diagnosis of asthma, it might mean when they start exercising, they start thinking, well, I'm out of breath, so it's got to be my asthma. And then some people might choose not to take part in physical activity because of their asthma, when actually their asthma might be well controlled and they might have a dysfunctional breathing pattern as well as their asthma. If they worked on their breathing pattern, then they may well be able to take part in sport and enjoy sport without any problems at all. So that holistic process and managing the patient holistically from a respiratory health point of view rather than picking out individual conditions is really important.
That's brilliant. And I think we're going to touch upon the dysfunctional breathing and potential dysfunctional breathing training later on. So we'll pick up on that shortly. So in terms of, you mentioned asthma, in terms of what many people do then for asthma is they'll take their inhaler. And obviously that's potentially what's going to help them with their breathing. So can you just explain to us what the inhaler is and what it does, and then why so many athletes, you know, would be taking it?
What's interesting there, you kind of said the inhaler, and actually there's lots of inhalers. So there's lots of colours. I'm sure people with asthma will be aware of the various colours. And basically there's two kind of mainstays of therapy. One's I guess he referred to as emergency therapy, reactive therapy. And that's maybe what we're most familiar thinking about asthma is the blue inhaler. So that's, and in that blue inhaler is a drug called salbutamol, and it's a short acting beta 2 agonist. What that therapy does, so the blue inhalers and also the green inhalers work do a similar thing, but over a longer period of time. When you inhale them into your lungs, what they do is they basically relax the smooth muscle around the airway. So when an individual experiences asthma, what happens is there's an inflammatory response to the asthma, to the trigger, and that could be pollution, could be dry air, etc. There's an inflammatory response, and that inflammatory response then causes the smooth muscle to constrict around the airway, which then makes it harder for the individual to breathe air out. So the blue inhaler, the salbutamol, when you inhale it into your lungs, it relaxes the smooth muscle. So it opens up the airway and it works really quickly. So once an individual inhales it, within 30 seconds to a minute, they start to feel that their airways are responding, and the maximum dilation happens around about 10 to 15 minutes after that inhalation. Now, what the issue with that is that it doesn't actually kind of solve the root cause of the problem. It doesn't deal with the inflammation. So what individuals with asthma should be doing is using what's called an inhaled corticosteroid on a regular basis. The inhaled corticosteroid is usually a Brown inhaler, or you can get it as a combination with a long-acting beta-2 agonist. It may be a purple inhaler you might see people use. Basically, the inhaled corticosteroid is the anti-inflammatory part. It dampens down the inflammatory response to the asthmogenic trigger going into the lungs. And if you dampen down the inflammation, you dampen down the potential severity of the asthma when the lungs come in touch with that asthma with the trigger. But also, you also reduce the chances of the lung undergoing what we call airway remodeling. And so the inflammation can cause what we call epithelial damage. So basically the cells in the lung, the airway, sort of the airway lining, can get damaged from too much inflammation. And over time, what happens, you can get almost permanent thickening of the wall. And so what we want to try and avoid that. So we want to avoid this airway remodeling. So using things like inhaled corticosteroids on a daily basis is what people with asthma should be doing. One of the reasons why they don't is partly because they're a little bit nervous about taking steroids over a long period of time. And also the inhaled corticosteroids takes around about 2 weeks to build up into your system to be effective. And so if you give an individual a Brown inhaler and a blue inhaler, when they feel symptomatic, their blue inhaler works great. The Brown inhaler doesn't seem to do anything. So they tend to not commit to it. So it's about education to individuals when you give them the inhalers, to make sure they're using the inhalers correctly, to make sure they're optimizing their prevention, not just on that acute time, but also long-term management of it. So, and alongside those two main inhalers, there are other inhalers as well. So there's lots of all the different add-on therapies that individuals might get alongside that. But the two main parts are the inhaled corticosteroids and the inhaled beta-2 agonist, which are kind of your blue inhalers.
And as you touched upon there, obviously you've already mentioned that a lot of athletes are asthmatic, and obviously they're going to be using, you know, various types of inhalers and steroids. And obviously this potentially has problems regarding WADA and doping.
Yeah.
So can you just elaborate? We had a conversation earlier. Can you just elaborate a little bit on the potential problems that some of these athletes have? I think you mentioned swimming and cycling in particular earlier.
Yeah, well I mean, I guess the WADA rules are relevant for all athletes. I think maybe there's been some high profile issues with certain athletes in certain sports recently in the papers and things, which probably why those two sports kind of cropped up. Now, in terms of the WADA rules, inhaled corticosteroids aren't banned at all. So athletes can use the Brown inhalers as I guess theoretically as much as they like, but they should be using it within what's been prescribed to them. So they can use inhaled corticosteroids without any issue at all. The things like inhaled salbutamol, so the blue inhaler, athletes are allowed to take up to 8 puffs, so 800 micrograms of salbutamol in a 12-hour period. And again, they don't, to use that medication like in that way, they don't have to submit any documentation. They just have to declare, if they're actually having a drugs test at the time, they just have to declare they've taken it and how much they've taken, but they don't have to get a special certificate or anything like that. What we know is that medication at that level, there's no evidence at the moment to say it improves endurance performance, strength performance on acute or long-term basis. No evidence to suggest that's the case. In fact, you could almost argue it's counterproductive, especially the taking too much beta-2 agonist might actually cause increases in heart rate and things. So for endurance performance, it almost has the opposite effect. But there are questions, though. If you start to take higher doses, potentially higher doses of beta-2 agonist can cause, it doesn't actually affect endurance performance. It's more because then you start to get sort of more general circulation of beta-2 agonist. And what that can do, if you take really high doses, is it can improve anaerobic performance, so it can improve power, and strength performance. And so higher doses of beta-2 agonists inhaled forms aren't allowed. And also oral forms of either beta-2 agonist or corticosteroid aren't allowed. So it's kind of a bit of a gray zone. What I would say is that elite athletes using medication as it's prescribed, they aren't cheating, and there's no evidence for that to be a performance enhancer. What the problem is when athletes start accessing what we call therapeutic use exemption, so they get permission to use kind of otherwise banned substances for a condition, and then it becomes a little bit of a gray zone as to whether athletes can manipulate the TUE system to be able to use a bit of a stronger medication to get the performance enhancement that they wouldn't otherwise get from sort of lower level drugs like inhaled forms of asthma therapy. And for an example, one example of that is a drug called tubutylene, which is similar to salbutamol, so it's a short acting beta-2 agonist, and that drug is an inhaled drug. And it can be an oral drug. Now, the reason why the inhaled form and the oral form are both banned is because you can't differentiate between an inhaled dose and an oral dose. But an athlete could present evidence where that their salbutamol inhaler, for whatever reason, isn't effective for them, but tubutylene is. And so therefore, they could get therapeutic use exemption to use a tubutylene inhaler rather than a salbutamol inhaler. However, once they've got that TUE for tubutylene, it kind of opens the door a little bit for the unscrupulous athlete to go, you know what, I can probably get away with having a big dose of oral tubutylene here and benefit from the performance, the strength and power performance. It's the same thing for oral corticosteroids. So oral corticosteroids is a drug called prednisolone, which is quite often given to very severe asthmatics if they are on the verge of being hospitalized or are hospitalized. And so it's usually only given to asthmatics in quite severe situations, and it's only given for a week or 2 weeks, so it's not usually, you wouldn't expect it to be given to an athlete that's about to compete at a world championship event. However, there are occasions when athletes have been kind of reported their asthma symptoms are significantly bad at the time, and their doctor has applied for a TUE for prednisolone. Now, prednisolone is actually allowed to be used outside of competition. So outside of 2 weeks before competition, athletes can use prednisolone without a TUE, but within 2 weeks, they need a TUE for it. And prednisolone potentially is a strong corticosteroid. It's a strong anti-inflammatory drug, so potentially it might, if an athlete's using it during competition, they might benefit from the anti-inflammatory effects of the drug, might get faster recovery times, might get reduction in perception of fatigue levels and things like that, so potentially it might improve their performance. But if the individual really has asthma and really needs the prednisolone, you've probably got a question, should they be on the starting lineup for a world championship competition anyway, because their body probably isn't in a very fit state to compete. So this becomes lesser, it's more, the use of the asthma therapy is probably more of a philosophical debate that needs to happen with some medics, and probably needs to have some big long debates, because I'm going on a little bit here, but it's quite a bit of a point. Hopefully people haven't heard me gone falling asleep. But one of the issues is that, for example, we had a lot of kind of furore around Bradley Wiggins in the press about getting a TUE for, and it wasn't actually an asthma therapy, it was an allergy therapy he got a TUE for. And what that has potentially had a knock-on effect is some athletes have gone, well, I don't want a TUE now, because if I get found out that I've used a TUE, I'm going to get put, you know, and Bradley didn't cheat. We have to remember that he didn't cheat, because it was the TUE was given and he used it under the license of the certificate. But obviously within the press, ethically, that was kind of questioned, whether that's ethically right to be doing that. And athletes might decide they don't want a TUE because they don't want to be tarnished with that brush of what's ethically right for an athlete to do. Now, if they decide they don't want that stronger medicine, when actually they need it from a health point of view, they might decide, well, I'll just rely on taking my salbutamol to get me through the competition or whatever. Now, the problem with that is an athlete's only allowed to take 800 micrograms of salbutamol. So they might be at risk of taking too many doses of that. And what we've seen is that if they take too many doses of that, they can be an elevation of salbutamol concentration in their urine, and then they give a positive, or they give an elevated urine concentration. So that becomes an adverse analytic finding. They've got to explain why that's in their system. So there's also kind of knock-on effects and little nuances around athletes using asthma therapy. What I always try and go back to, though, is an athlete is well-controlled, well-medicated and well-managed. They shouldn't really be needing to go anywhere near the TUEs. And if they do, it's probably some severe exacerbation. And if they do need to go somewhere near the TUEs or on competition, then there's got to be some serious questions whether that athlete should be competing at that particular time. But then, you know, that's a medical decision between the medic and the athlete themselves.
Joe, that's a really good insight into kind of all sides of the story there, and especially the piece on, you know, athletes now not wanting to take these TUEs because they might be seen as drugs cheats, and actually it might affect their health. That's a really interesting, you know, way of putting that across. You did mention kind of dysfunctional breathing and asthma diagnosis. Can asthma be misdiagnosed? Because you mentioned there was numerous factors that could affect respiratory breathing rates and things.
Yes, is the answer to that. Asthma can be misdiagnosed. And a lot of the time, one of the reasons for that is because there's not one perfect test for asthma, whether that be sort of asthma in the general population or asthma within an athletic population. There are some tests, and using a combination of tests do get you a more definitive answer. But part of the reason why you get misdiagnosed is the knowledge of the medic treating the individual, the accessibility to the irrelevant tests as well. And so what we know is, if we, for example, if an athlete just reports to their GP saying, when I exercise I get short of breath, find it really difficult to breathe, I'm wheezing a little bit when I'm exercising, so they're all symptoms you might associate with asthma. We know if diagnosis alone is made on just symptoms, the diagnosis is wrong 50% of the time. So it's like flipping a coin. So just diagnosing asthma on symptoms isn't particularly helpful. We know in the general population there's a misdiagnosis rate of asthma of about 33%. So in the general population, asthma diagnosis isn't being particularly well carried out. And again, that might be a combination of accessibility to testing as well, as much as it is about the tests themselves being not particularly. I guess the tests are good as long as they're interpreted correctly. But just for an example's sake, there's two different types of asthma tests. One is a what we call a direct airway challenge, and within that, usually carried out in a hospital, it's called a methacholine challenge. And direct airway challenges, they basically directly stimulate your smooth muscle in your airway. So at a given concentration of methacholine, everybody's lung function will react to it, and so therefore you'll get a tightening. But there are cutoffs in terms of they kind of say a certain concentration below that is a positive test and likely to be may mean the individual has asthma. But a positive test to that doesn't confirm asthma, but a negative test rules out asthma. So you can't confirm it, but you can rule it out. The other way around of doing it is to maybe, for example, with an athlete, you might do an exercise challenge. So you might say, well, let's measure their lung function and let's try and trigger off the asthma. So we then ask the individual to go and do some sort of hard exercise that might bring on their symptoms or might replicate kind of their hardest piece of training or hardest part of their sport. And we basically ask them to do that real high intense piece of activity for maybe 10 minutes. We measure their lung function before they start and measure it after they finish. And what we're looking for is a drop off in their lung function after they finished. And they might give you a negative test. And the flip side, basically an indirect dairy challenge works in a different way. So if you're positive to the indirect dairy challenge, it kind of confirms the asthma or the exercise-induced asthma. But if you're negative to it, it doesn't rule it out. So you kind of have these kind of sort of nuances and you need, so it needs skilled practitioners to be able to, one, yes, we still need symptoms. We still want to take a patient history to get a good idea of what's what the individual's kind of reporting, but also need to understand the strengths and weaknesses of the testing as well. And so, for an example, to get a diagnosis of asthma, you might need to do it in two or three different tests to get the evidence you need. Within athletes, we've kind of developed quite a nice systematic respiratory health overview that allows us to do that, and we use quite a sensitive test. And again, this is a lovely name of a test that we'll get into another one in a little bit, but this one's called a eucapnic voluntary hyperpnea challenge. So it's called an EVH challenge, and what that means is we basically sit, instead of asking an athlete to exercise, we basically ask them to breathe as if they're exercising, but we give them a massive dose of dry air, and basically they breathe really hard for 6 minutes. And that test is really sensitive, but maybe it's overly sensitive because it's 6 minutes of breathing dry air at about an intensity that you'd be at maybe during a VO2 max test, at the very end of a VO2 max test. So maybe an individual wouldn't breathe like that during exercise. But what it does is it tells us that individual potentially can experience exercise-induced asthma during competition. And so by being a little bit sort of oversensitive with the test, at least we're picking up the ones that have a potential to go. And from my experience of 20 years of doing the testing, I've only ever had two or three individuals that give me a negative test to EVH. But then when we've exercised them maybe during the pollen season, which may be their main trigger, they've given us a positive test. So again, it's not that one test itself isn't perfect for everybody, but it does give you a good general overview of whether individuals like to have asthma or not. So to answer your question short, yes, you can get misdiagnosed with asthma, but the reason for that is because there's not a one perfect test for it.
And Sam, I'm aware you're sat on the sidelines with us there, so apologies for keeping you there for too long. And I'm going to attempt to name another test that you've been involved with and get it wrong. So can you explain to us that the testing that you've been done? So I'm reading here. So the optoelectronic plethysmography. I've got that wrong again, haven't I? Go on, Sam, put me out of my misery.
Optoelectronic plethysmography.
Plethysmography, was that right?
That's right, yeah.
There we go. A bit better when I copy off you. So can you explain to us what that is and how it helps with the diagnosis of asthma?
Sure. So optoelectronic plethysmography, and we do have an acronym for it, so you can call it OEP instead, and that's easier to say. But this is Definitely. This is based on motion capture technology. So often during the sort of DVDs on the making of an animation film or whatever, you see these actors walking around with these kind of reflective markers on. And we have similar systems in biomechanics. So we have these reflective markers, we've got lots of cameras around the room that can detect the motion of this. When we're doing respiratory testing, we have markers basically from your shoulders down to your pelvis, so just around your waist, and then front, back and sides all around your chest, in quite a high density grid of markers. And as those move in and out as you breathe, basically that allows us to do everything that a kind of traditional lung function testing in terms of spirometry might allow us to do. So we can track things like the volume and the timing and the speed of expired air. But in addition to that, because we've got lots and lots of markers, we can actually track individual sections of the chest and how they move, and we can compare the relative timing of these different sections and how much different sections are contributing to the overall breath volume. So for example, we've talked about belly breathing and chest breathing. You know, we can detect if somebody's using that section of their chest or not. And it turns out that this is a really good way to detect some of these dysfunctional breathing techniques, because a dysfunctional breath is likely to happen when, for example, these different sections of the chest aren't moving together, so they're moving out of phase. So you might move your upper chest before your abdomen, or the other way round, or it can show up that perhaps you're not using as much of a certain part of your chest as a healthy person breathing normally would do. So, for example, there might be less motion at the shoulders or whatever. So that's basically what OEP is. And actually, I was really surprised, having when we started, not knowing much about dysfunctional breathing. But actually, the things that we track show up the dysfunctional breathing really, really well. And it can give you a complete picture of what's going on. And it actually looks very different to what a healthy breath is, and very different again to how asthmatic breathing looks.
So what exactly is it that you've kind of picked out from your research? How do you diagnose, you know, this dysfunctional breathing? And then how do you retrain people to breathe properly?
John, do you want to maybe talk about kind of what you see with athletes?
Yeah. So again, this is some of the really, for me, this has been the really exciting stuff that the collaboration between myself and Sam has really, really kind of kickstarted our understanding, because prior to having the accessibility to do this testing of breathing pattern using OEP, a lot of it's been based on people like myself or respiratory physios basically just watching people breathe and basically trying to get an idea of the way they're moving their rib cage. So I guess dysfunctional breathing, like Sam say, can happen in different ways. So there's different types of dysfunctional breathing. So I to kind of simplify, I've tried to put it into kind of three categories. The first one is simply a hyperventilation state where the movement isn't necessarily wrong, but it's just too fast. So you're basically breathing more than you need to breathe per minute in terms of breath frequency, and the actual breath, each breath is probably a bit too small. So you end up just breathing very shallow. So it's a sort of thing. Another type is where we expect that the lower rib cage and upper rib cage to kind of move together in a nice synchronized phase. So as you're breathing in, your abdomen and lower cage moves at the same time as your upper rib cage. Now, what we see is, so in some individuals, they get what we call asynchronization. So their lower rib cage and their abdomen move before their upper rib cage moves. So we call that an asynchronic breathing pattern. The other type that we see is maybe an apical breathing pattern. So there's a lot of shoulder movement and a lot of locking in the upper rib cage. And so we don't see, even though we get a lot of shoulder movement, we don't actually see that much movement in the kind of the upper rib cage. And a lot of the movement happens in the lower rib cage. And the individuals just feel they can't get a full expansion in their rib cage. Now, all of those different types of dysfunctional breathing pattern can happen in isolation, but sometimes you see a bit of a combination of hyperventilation with asynchrony, or asynchrony but also with apical breathing, so a lot of shoulder movement as well. So it's not that there's three different types and you fit into one. Sometimes you kind of might be a bit of one and a bit of another one. And so the way that you go about working with an individual, the key thing is that I've found working with the individuals with dysfunctional breathing patterns is videoing them and showing them what they're doing. What's great about the OEP is we've actually been able to develop a real-time feedback. So if you educate the individual about what the figures and the graphs show that we can beam up from the OEP, we can show them what that movement actually produces in terms of their rib cage movement, and also how much air they're breathing per breath. And so once you actually tell the individual, look, you think you're breathing well, and a lot of people, when I first tell them, you know what, the reason why you can't can't breathe very well when you're doing maybe repeated sprint training or anything or something like that, it's just simply because you're not breathing properly. They look at you and go, nah, can't be that. Can't be because I'm not breathing right. Can't be because my movement's not right. Because no, you know, you just breathe, don't you? No one teaches you how to breathe. You just breathe. But actually, when you actually show them and you educate them about what should happen, they go, oh, okay. And then they try and explain to them to get that lower ribcage movement, to get the synchronization together. Suddenly when people do that, they it feels different. It's a bit like, you know, you might be a swimmer and then your coach says, actually, I want your arm to go in a bit higher up, or your elbow to point up, and it feels horrible to start off with. But actually you change the breathing pattern, you make the synchrony better, you make the movement of the ribcage greater, the individual can breathe more air per breath. They actually feel it. It feels brilliant for them because there's no sort of tension, no tightness in their chest. So it makes it, we're trying to make this breathing effortless, basically. And if you're a really, really efficient breather, even though you're breathing hard, it shouldn't feel that's the reason why you can't go any faster. So we'd basically we educate the individual about how they're breathing, and then to actually retrain them is a bit of a combination of various things. So part of it is breathing pattern training and actually simply just trying to get that movement pattern better. Part of it might be actually working on the posture. So we know postural positioning can affect breathing pattern, so we might do a little bit of postural work. We also might bring in some inspiratory muscle training to try and make the respiratory muscles a bit stronger, and that can also be used to promote a better breathing pattern. We might do some anxiety sort of control, so we might bring in sports psychology into it, because a lot of these individuals might just be a little bit anxious about breathing during high intensity training. They might have built up a little bit of a expectation about how they should be feeling with their breathing during high intensity work. And there might be other things we might bring in as well. So we have to look at it holistically. And some people, it is just the education. Other people, it's dealing with the anxiety. Some other people, they need a bit of everything. And how quickly people can respond to that, again, it's difficult to say. I've had some people where I've educated them and they've gone from not being able to run 30 seconds on a treadmill to doing a 30-minute run on a treadmill within a day. And it's literally just like the pennies drop and they go, oh, that's how you breathe, and off they go. Other people I've had take over a year to crack it, and we've helped them and overcome it. And some of those individuals have gone on to be Olympic champions. So it's kind of how long it takes depends on the individual, depends on how quickly they can buy in and basically change their breathing pattern. Which, you know, just imagine someone coming up to you and saying you're not walking right, you need to walk with you, you need to plant your foot slightly differently. It feels horrible to start off with. So to change these kind of ingrained movement patterns within the body can take a little bit of time and a little bit of trust. And during exercise, it's probably the hardest time to change it, because that's when there's the most stress going through the body.
One of the really good things about the OEP system is that it is dealing with numbers, and I think athletes and coaches like to see numbers, and so you can sort of give them that information about it. It's not just a kind of video where you have to sort of interpret it a little bit subjectively. With the OEP system, you can actually see that somebody's kind of got 10% better in terms of, you know, their volume, or, you know, that their synchronicity has come back into phase, or has at least moved back towards being in phase. So you do get that kind of that quantitative improvement. And as John said, you can give them this sort of real-time feedback display, so they can see it changing as you're working with them and kind of trying out different visualizations and that type of thing. And the really good thing about you know, a sort of motion capture based system is that you're not tied to a particular spot, and you can be assessing people actually while they're exercising. So it's not the case that, for example, with the sort of traditional spirometry system, you actually have to kind of stop them while they do it and they perform a particular sort of test technique. You're actually testing them, you know, while they're on the treadmill running or while they're on the bike cycling. And I think the kind of additional insights that you gain from that are really valuable.
Yeah, and just go on to that number thing. One of the reasons why I'm really excited about it is I've been helping athletes overcome breathing problems like this for 20 years, but I've never had anything really objective to say, we've taken you from A to B. And so, for example, sometimes it's been quite hard to get sports medics supporting the athlete or physiotherapists supporting the athlete to really buy into doing it, because we haven't got any numbers to go, yes, we've improved them by 10-20% and their breathing pattern has changed. And so that is going to be long term, that's really, really crucial and really big step change in what we can kind of offer the athlete and their support team.
And John, I think you touched upon there that, I mean, we talked a lot here about athletes, but I think you touched upon general population a little bit when you said you could have somebody on there for, you know, 30 seconds who could then run for a minute. Mm-hmm. Obviously, in the current climate with COVID-19 and breathing, have we got any information about, you know, how breathing's being affected with COVID and if any of this could actually help anybody?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the, and again, there's always a few issues with that actual diagnosis of dysfunctional breathing in the general population, because again, a lot of it's made on reports on symptoms, maybe questionnaires, and again, obviously there's issues around that. But what I'd probably say generally is there's certainly a group of individuals that maybe you might classify them post-COVID, or you call them long COVID, or whatever you want to call them, but they are reporting more breathlessness on exertion than maybe they did before they had COVID infection. Now, why that is, there potentially are a few reasons for it. Some of it might be that there might be compromised their ability to diffuse oxygen across into their body might be a little bit compromised now. We're pretty sure that COVID, there's not particularly strong evidence from what I've seen that COVID has affected lung function in terms of the volume of air that people can move and the speed it moves in and out of the airways. But what COVID can do is potentially, I guess I try and liken it to, it's a bit like having a sprained ankle, and you might change your walking gait to walk around your sprained ankle, and you might change your breathing pattern to breathe around kind of your COVID infection, if you like. And sometimes if you've had a quite severe case of COVID, or you've had that kind of issue, there might be something in the back of your kind of psyche that says, you know what, I just don't want to breathe how I used to breathe. And you might want to control it a little bit more. And if you try and over control your breathing pattern, you can develop dysfunctional breathing patterns quite easily. And so we might see, well, we know that there's more people reporting symptoms post-COVID. And a lot of those we don't know, because we haven't been able to put many people through tests like OEP. We don't know whether they've kind of had this kind of chronic change in their breathing pattern, or whether it's something a bit more physiologically based. It's actually something's changed within their lung function. But I've seen people maybe in different situations. I've seen people have a bad chest infection and then develop a dysfunctional breathing pattern after having a bad chest infection for a long period of time. And might be something similar going on with COVID as well. But again, that's really exciting, using this kind of OEP system. And probably one of the other things that OEP is, and we probably haven't really touched on it, I mean, it's an assessment that can be done at distance. So once you've got all the marks on an individual, you can kind of step right back and let them kind of do all the deep breathing or all the exercise you like, whereas using spirometry, which is traditionally done, or using even breath by breath analysis that might be done on a cardiopulmonary exercise test, they're probably a little bit higher risk in terms of transmission of COVID and things. Whereas the OEP does allow assessments with people with maybe quite recently after having a COVID infection and things, because it's a little bit less invasive, and it's an assessment that can be done a bit more at distance.
Yeah, there's no tubes kind of collecting anything that you then have to clear up afterwards and disinfect.
Yeah, nobody likes taking the thing out of your mouth after a VO2 max test. Everywhere. We've all been there, I'm sure. So Sam, I know that you've been doing some research, obviously moving on a little bit from COVID. We're all wearing face masks now, and I think we've been doing some research at Loughborough. Could you just enlighten us a little bit on that, please?
Yeah, so as John said, potentially one of the issues, although we really don't know, with the sort of long COVID and the breathlessness, is that there might be something at the back of the mind that's changing the breathing pattern. And one of the things that we're looking at is whether or not that might happen with mask use. So it's a little bit different now. I mean, we're sort of recording this on the day that everything is sort of starting to open back up. But when the infection rates were really, really high before, and also remembering that other countries still have very high infection rates, and also that this might not be our kind of, you know, last respiratory pandemic that we experience in our lifetimes, although fingers crossed. One of the things that that people have suggested is that when you're exercising outdoors, as you're breathing more heavily, you're more likely to kind of aerosolize more and potentially spread COVID to people, even though you're outside, because of the increased sort of breathing that you're doing. So one of the suggestions has been potentially people should try wearing masks when they're doing exercise outside, if they're in a very populated area, so that they don't spread COVID around. Now, that's pretty unpopular. I mean, people feel as though it's uncomfortable to wear a mask when they're breathing heavily during exercise. And we wondered why that might be. And obviously, one of the key questions is it because potentially their breathing pattern changes with the mask use, potentially because they're sort of panicking or whatever, because they've got some anxiety because they've got this mask across their face? And is it more the anxiety or the expectation of discomfort that's then changing their breathing pattern, and that change in breathing pattern, perhaps because they become asynchronous or they become constricted in a certain part of their chest, that it's that change in breathing pattern that's causing people to feel uncomfortable when they're wearing a mask? We know, for example, there's been a number of studies that have shown that if you run with a mask on, there's no change in your blood oxygenation. So they've shown that using these sort of pulse oximeters. So we know that oxygen is getting through, but really we're trying to explain this discomfort. And if it is due to a change in the breathing, in the way that people are breathing in terms of the breathing patterns, then that means that we can use some of the techniques that John has talked about in terms of re-educating people with dysfunctional breathing to get them sort of breathing normally with a mask. And that might be of use in the future, you know, particularly in countries where infection rates might still be high, you know, or if we ever have to deal with this kind of situation again.
Let's hope not.
Yes,
so with your guys' research, yeah, definitely. With your guys' research, kind of what's next? What's the future? So we've seen almost an evolution really towards this OEP kind of system that you're now using. Where's it going to next? Because, you know, having been around biomechanics a few years ago, sticking all the little dots on people and things like that, is there somewhere this evolves to, or what are we looking forward to?
Yeah, I'll kick off, right, Sam, and then set some follow up. So, I mean, so in terms of what's next, I'm quite excited about it, partly because the OEP itself is just actually kind of give us a really nice visualization of what dysfunctional breathing pattern is. And so what with the OEP, we need to start getting a kind of substantial data set to allow us to kind of get what might be kind of cut off points, so we can actually use OEP to objectively kind of maybe diagnose a dysfunctional breathing pattern. Because at the moment we can kind of say, well, that's a little bit maybe away from the norm, but it'd be nice to have some cutoffs from the OEP, and we might be able to get them for various things. So it might not be just dysfunctional breathing we can do it with. You can potentially do it with asthma or with COPD and other respiratory problems. So that's kind of that's probably going to happen within the next year or two, hopefully. But long term, what we really need to try and do is try and produce something that makes the technology more accessible. So OEP itself, you need really skilled practitioners like Sam. You need a very expensive lab to be able to do it. You need time to analyze all the data. And so that practically isn't really going to be very accessible to most people who maybe have a breathing problem. So what we're trying to do is trying to look for methods that we can maybe that allow us to take measurements similar to OEP, but allow us, you know, and that could be using cameras, it could be using skin-based sensors, could be all sorts of there's all sorts of options out there. But if we can make something that is more user-friendly and accessible, that means that your asthma nurse or your GP can utilize that technology to diagnose at a kind of a community kind of care level. It means that more athletes around the world are going to get better real-time feedback on their breathing pattern when they're exercising, to get a good indication whether it's asthma or whether it's dysfunctional breathing. So that's where we really need to move it. The difficulty is, if it was that easy, it would already be done. So it's a challenge, but it's one of those things that we're really excited about, because what it's going to involve is collaboration. I mean, myself and Sam already collaborated from a kind of a exercise physiologist and a biomechanist, and now we need collaboration from more in an engineer environment to kind of sort of take it to that kind of level. So it's going to be a kind of a nice interdisciplinary research question to answer, I think, going forwards. But it's really exciting, and hopefully we're going to be sat here in about 10 years time all knowing how we're breathing, because we got like a little app on our phone and we can go, yeah, I mean, I've got a really good breathing pattern today. And that's kind of where we want to be.
That does sound really exciting. Sam, is there anything to add to that, or has he hit the nail on the head with all that?
Yeah, I think John's covered it. I mean, one of the things that we're looking at in particular is around just being able to use sort of webcams or sort of smartphone cameras or that level of camera, you know, cheap, easily accessible, that type of thing. As John says, not just for treatment in this country, but actually if you think about kind of the wider world that's out there, in perhaps countries, again, you know, where coronavirus infection rates are higher or where potentially it's difficult to kind of transport a lot of medical equipment around, it might be difficult to transport spirometry kits and everything that's needed to disinfect them in the current climate around. If you could monitor somebody's breathing pattern and do things like, you know, diagnose whether it's asthma or dysfunctional breathing, or to support somebody's breathing technique or their recovery from COVID or lots of other respiratory conditions in some of those countries around the world, that would be really hugely beneficial as well. So it's kind of, you know, asthma is a global problem. And I think a couple of years ago, it was the World Health Organization, it was part of their sort of grand challenges. Rates of asthma are still sort of increasing around the world because of things like pollution and climate change and that type of thing. So in actual fact, respiratory monitoring and being able to do that cheaply and easily and getting a really good picture of somebody's complete breathing pattern technique has really wide applications and implications.
Brilliant. So, I mean, just to finish off, really, obviously we've heard a lot about breathing, and I promised people they would understand how we breathe after listening. I'm sure we've got a lot of in-depth knowledge from you guys, so thank you very much. But if anybody wanted to kind of move forward from listening to this and, you know, potentially use the systems you've been talking about or identify dysfunctional breathing or look at how to improve their technique, is there any way you could direct them to kind of find some more information on this?
Yeah, I've run a couple of respiratory clinics myself. So at the University of Kent, we've got a respiratory clinic where people can kind of self-refer themselves to me. If you just simply looked up exercises respiratory clinic University of Kent on Google or whatever, then you'd probably like to find us. I've also got a clinic out the Centre of Health and Human Performance based in London in Harley Street. So there are kind of clinics out there that individuals can source, because it's not always the case that the kind of the GP or community care practice has that kind of specialisation in exercise and spiritual problems. I'm sure me and Sam are quite happy for our emails to be kind of out there. People, I'm quite happy to answer them. I've also just edited a book. If people want a bit more interest, they can always look up The Complete Guide to Respiratory Care in Athletes. It's more for the practitioner working with an athlete, but it certainly gives you a really good insight into all the respiratory problems that athletes might face.
Brilliant. That is exactly the kind of resource we're talking about. Sam, have you got anything to add?
We're also sort of setting up studies and testing at Loughborough as well, you know, with John's support. And we actually have a PhD position starting very soon, which will continue looking at using OEP to diagnose and retrain. So we'll be looking for participants in the local area as well for all of those studies that will be starting fairly soon.
Perfect. Well, it's been great talking to you both. Thanks very much for coming on, and thanks for giving us an insight into respiratory physiology and breathing. So thanks a lot. I'll speak to you again soon.
Your pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Loughborough Sportcast. If you want to get in touch and let us know any subject areas or experts that you'd be keen to listen to, then contact me, Martin Foster, on m.foster@alborough.ac.uk or tweet me at martinfoster82. Bye for now. We'll see you next time.